Hi, welcome to USCogens, the international law podcast. Today, we are going to talk about the Special Tribunal for Lebanon. And joining me today is Olga Kavran, who is the former head of outreach and legacy at STL in Beirut from 2010 to 2020. She has also formerly worked with the ICTY. She specializes in international law, is pursuing a PhD on international criminal courts and the right to public trial. What is the obligation of international criminal courts in providing information to the public, and how does it contribute to their non-judicial aims? So thank you, Olga, for joining me today. It's lovely to have you and you have this chat on STL. Tell me a bit about, let's start with STL. How was it formed? Why was it formed? And yeah, what was the big idea behind it?
Thanks very much for hosting me. I'm very happy to be here. So in terms of the STL was established following the massive car bomb attack that killed the former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri on Valentine's Day in 2005 in downtown Beirut. The international community reacted, determined that this was a threat internationally. It was also the Lebanese government that in fact requested the establishment of an international tribunal, or an internationalized tribunal as they formulated it at the time. So following a negotiation between the UN and Lebanon on how to establish this institution and on the statute and everything else, there were, due to a political impasse that happened in Lebanon, in the end, instead of the tribunal being created by an agreement, which was the initial intention, an agreement between the UN and Lebanon, such as there was, for example, when they created the Special Court for Sierra Leone. Due to the political impasse in Lebanon, the Lebanese Prime Minister requested the UN to establish the institution instead. And so that's what happened. The UN Security Council passed a resolution in 2007 by which it established and put into force the agreement that had been reached between Lebanon and the UN establishing the tribunal. The tribunal actually opened its doors on the 1st of March 2009 and it began its work. The first indictment was issued in 2011 and the case concluded in 2018 with the judgment in the main case being having been rendered in August 2020. The jurisdiction of the tribunal, as was determined by its statute, was for the attack against Rafik Hariri and any other attacks that might be connected to the attack against Hariri. And the connection would have to be in the nature and the gravity of the crimes, and can include, but is not necessarily limited to, the intent behind the crime, the purpose behind the attacks, the nature of the victims, the pattern of the attacks, and or the perpetrators. And so the in terms of time frame, these connected cases would have to have fallen between the 1st of October 2004 and the 12th of December 2005. And any other date after that, but only with the agreement of Lebanon, the UN, and the approval of the Security Council. So this latter part of the jurisdiction has not been triggered. So far, what the tribunal has done is it has adjudicated the main case in the assassination of the former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. And it's also in the pretrial phase for one of the connected, for a connected case that will deal with three other attacks that occurred in Lebanon, assassinations and attempted assassinations. So that case is still in pretrial and is due to begin, it's expected to begin in June this year.
Right. So I have reason to believe that STL is a very unique tribunal. That you know, it came with a lot of firsts compared to other tribunals like ICTY, ICTR. So how is it different than all these other tribunals that we hear about?
And that's true. It is, in fact, as you say, a tribunal of many firsts, as has been pointed out. So the one of the things is its jurisdiction, right? It's the first international tribunal with jurisdiction over terrorism. All the other international and hybrid tribunals that have been established thus far have jurisdiction for what we often refer to as mass atrocity crimes, those being crimes against humanity, genocide, war crimes, and so on. And of course, the ICC has jurisdiction over aggression as well, but none have jurisdiction over terrorism. So the SDL was the first tribunal to have jurisdiction over terrorism. It's also the first tribunal to have jurisdiction over a country in this particular region, namely Lebanon. And it's also the first, it's the first institution to international criminal court to allow trials in absentia, meaning in the absence of the accused. And this is in fact the case with the tribunal's main case. The accused had never been apprehended, so they were tried, the four individuals were tried in their absence. The STL is also the first tribunal that has a defense office. Now, this is, I need to go back a little bit just to mention the structure of these courts, and that it usually includes three organs: the chambers, which is the judges, the prosecution, which is the prosecutors, investigators, and so forth, and the registry, which is the most diverse of the organs and has both an administrative and a judicial function. So this is what happens in most of the other, almost all the other courts and tribunals, whereas the STL, based on lessons learned from previous tribunals, based on comments in academic literature and so forth, established a defense office as a organ, as an organ which is on an equal footing, if you will, with the other three, and the purpose of which is to assist defense counsel in their work. So the defense office does not represent individual accused, they assist counsel who do. So this is a first as well. And again, it will remain to, again, the academic community and other analysts to do an assessment following the closure of the STL as to whether this was in fact an effective solution or not. And finally, it's interesting to note that the STL was also the first tribunal that put the establishment of an outreach program in its rules of procedure and evidence. All the other international courts also have outreach programs, but they're usually regulated through internal regulations as opposed to being elevated to the level of inclusion in the rules of procedure and evidence. So that's a step in the right direction. And hopefully, again, I feel very strongly about this subject for obvious reasons. Hopefully some institution at a later date will also include the necessity in its statute. But that remains to be seen. But that's the list of, and one final thing, which is also interesting, is that the STL is the first tribunal where victims could actually personally attend the proceedings in the courtroom, which they did do throughout the trial.
No, that's really helpful. So based on all these unique features, how do you think the STL is received by the people of Lebanon, given that it applies Lebanese criminal law, but it still is the layer above the national courts? It has some hybrid nature, perhaps. How would you compare it to other international criminal tribunals?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Lebanon is a very complex country with a very complex political structure and situation, particularly now. And what I could say is that the tribunal enjoys the support of those who politically align or feel that they're politically aligned with what they see the aims to be. It finds itself at at opposite ends, so to speak, with those who don't feel that they're politically aligned to the tribunal. And the reason I point this out is because even the supporters of the tribunal sometimes do not support it for the right reasons, because they have a political agenda, which relates to something that the tribunal cannot do, which is outlaw groups and so forth. So it's always been a very interesting task trying to explain not only to the opponents, but also to the supporters of the institution, the limitations of the mandate and the actual jurisdiction of the STL. So that's one thing that's been a challenge. Another thing that's been a challenge in that respect is that Lebanon is a country where there isn't much trust in the judiciary at all. And so, I mean, it's one of the reasons why the STL was established in the first place. And so when people don't have trust in their own local judiciary, they're not immediately trusting of an international judicial organization either. Plus, in fairness, the Security Council resolutions, which relate to Lebanon and to its neighbors, have very rarely been actually upheld and honored by the countries in question. And so when you come and you try to explain to people the importance of international justice, they can be extremely skeptical based on the local situation, and it's quite understandable. On top of that, Lebanon is also a country that has unfortunately seen dozens upon dozens of political assassinations, and including very high-level figures, former presidents, and so forth. So a lot of people also asked the question, how come an institution was established for this particular assassination or this particular group of assassinations and not previously? And this brings me to something that is very similar between STL, ICTY, and I would argue other international courts. People very often raise the same concerns and the same issues. Why now? Why us? And not any number of crimes previously. Also, they see it as an attack against a country's sovereignty. And these are the kinds of issues that people raise regardless of whether they're in Lebanon or the former Yugoslavia or in some other places over which these kinds of courts have jurisdiction.
Right. You briefly, talked about the context of the tribunal, its jurisdiction. If we talk a bit about the August 2020 judgment, what was the verdict? What did it actually say? And why do you think they're coming out? How do you see this?
Well, there's a number of reasons, and you're absolutely right that the main reason is, not the only reason, but the main reason is the horrific blast that occurred on the 4th of August in Beirut. And the judgment was supposed to be issued on the 8th of August, and it was then postponed due to the blast and out of piety for all the victims. And so it was issued in the aftermath of the most devastating non-nuclear explosion anywhere really in recent history. So that's certainly one reason why the judgment did not get the attention that it might have done otherwise. There are other reasons, however. So much has happened in Lebanon over the past 15 years, in the intervening 15 years. That it's difficult for the victims obviously were very interested in the outcome of the judgment, but the rest of society has moved on in many different ways. I mean, we've had the war in Syria, which brought over 2 million refugees into Lebanon. We've had a complete economic collapse of the country. We had what many Lebanese refer to as the revolution in 2019. There's so many things that have happened in this country in the past, in the intervening years, that it's kind of diminished the impact of the judgment itself. In terms of the judgment, what happened was that the judges convicted one individual, by the name of Salim Jamil Ayash, of his role in the planning and execution of this very complex crime. Now, I think it's very interesting to point out a little bit more, or to give you a little bit more information about the judgment itself, because saying that it resulted in the conviction of one person doesn't actually do it justice. I mean, it's an accurate representation of a fact, except that it doesn't actually give you the full picture. So the judgment itself, it comes after 415 days of trial and nearly 300 witnesses. Over 170,000 pages have been entered into evidence. Okay. And the judgment itself is 2,641 pages. And the judges, for the first time, as far as I'm aware, in the international courts, in order to facilitate the understanding of the case and understanding, of course, and accepting that most people will not read the 2,500 pages, they also issued an authoritative summary of 150 pages, which makes it much more much easier for those interested in the judgment to actually access the information. So what happened was Mr. Hariri, the former prime minister who was assassinated, was a very well protected man. He had both private protection and he had that protection provided by the Lebanese state. So in order to assassinate somebody that well protected, the perpetrators had to go to great lengths, and the judges established that they did exactly that, and they listed a number of activities which had to have taken place in order for this crime to happen. And they include obtaining a detailed knowledge of Mr. Hariri's movements and his convoy, which, mind you, included at all times 6 or 7 vehicles, including an ambulance that was traveling with the convoy. They established closed mobile networks for communications between those who had a role in the plot. They had to choose a method of assassination. They had to obtain the car, the vehicle, which happened to be a Mitsubishi Canter van that was used for the assassination. They had to pick a suitable site for the explosion. And they did so. They picked an area which would create a specific canyon effect to amplify the explosion. They had to select a manner of detonation and recruit a suicide bomber. They had to get the explosives. The judges found that the equivalent of around 2.5 to 3 tons of TNT exploded on that day. And they even went so far as to set up a false claim of responsibility. So what they had done is they had apparently kidnapped and disappeared a young man by the name of Abu Adas, who was recorded as admitting to have assassinated Rafiq Hariri. And this videotape was placed by the perpetrators in a tree outside or across from the Al Jazeera bureau in Lebanon. And the bureau chief was then invited, or rather instructed on threat of attack, to play that videotape. And the idea, of course, was the intention was to divert the attention to a non, as it turns out, a non-existent militant group that was allegedly behind the plot. So the perpetrators went through enormous lengths in order to both organize and commit the crime, but then also to set up a false claim of responsibility so as to divert attention from themselves. So what the investigators did was they found a pattern in the use of mobile phones. So they analyzed thousands upon thousands upon thousands of mobile phone calls, not the content of the calls, but what they referred to as metadata. These are the records that the mobile companies collect in order to be able to issue a bill at the end of the month. And these records contain the outgoing and incoming telephone numbers, the duration of the call or the text message, as well as the cell towers, which are triggered when the phone is in use. or when the phone is actually connecting to the cell tower, because our mobile phones connect to cell towers when we're simply passing through town. We don't necessarily have to be using them for that to happen. So it was the first time, as far as I'm aware, certainly at an international tribunal, but I think even nationally, that practically the entire case hinged on telecommunications evidence. And so the investigators analyzed thousands of phone calls to establish these patterns. And then the judges had to go and do the same in order to determine whether the prosecutors have indeed established the patterns that they claimed that they saw. And what they found was that at least 10 and possibly many more individuals were involved using four different but interconnected mobile networks. And what do they mean by that? So you had a network, for example, that was whose purpose was the purchase of the vehicle that was used for the bombing. And so they would use the telephones that they had solely for that purpose and nothing else. When there was another group that was in charge of surveillance, and this group would use their phones only to conduct the surveillance and not for other purposes, and so on and so forth. So it's a very complex, very, very intricate planning that went into the commission of this crime. And frankly, it's really remarkable that we know anything about how the crime was committed when you look at the lengths to which the perpetrators went to conceal their identities. Because don't forget, this was back in 2004, 2005, when we didn't have the kinds of smartphones that we have today. They were using the older mobile phones. They were not giving, when they bought the phones, they did not give their identities. And so what the investigators had to do is try to identify these individuals based on the usage of the phones. And so, for example, they would conclude things like, if a particular telephone was always at a particular location in the evening hours or the night hours between say 10 or 11 at night and 6 and 7 in the morning, then the fair assumption is that this is a residence of the particular individual, because this is where the phone is during the night. Whereas conversely, if the same phone is found at a different location during normal working hours, the safe assumption is that this is the place of work of the individual in question, and so on. So they used these kinds of analyses in order to ascertain, in some cases, they were able to ascertain the identity of individuals. In other cases, they weren't. And so these people are simply listed under a pseudonym, if you will, or under a code that they refer to them as Subject 7 or Subject 6 or something like this, because they simply could not ascertain the name of each individual. Those who were identified were, of course, indicted, and one of them was convicted. The other three were acquitted.
Right. That's very interesting, and it seems like a very difficult case for gathering evidence based on what you have just mentioned. And 2,500 pages is anyway a very long judgment to read. You just mentioned that there were three other individuals who were accused but were found non-guilty, while Ayash was found, guilty on 5 counts relating to the attack. So what about those three other individuals? What did the court have to say about them?
Well, they found that they could not convict because they could not be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that these individuals committed the crimes that they were charged with. So basically, this is a threshold that must be reached in each international and also national court, of course. So if the judges are not satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a very high threshold, they cannot convict someone. So they found that this threshold was met only in the case of Mr. Salim Jamil Ayash. There is an appeal that was filed by the prosecutors, so we will see if the appeals chamber might have a different view. But in my experience at international courts, usually in such cases, the trial would be returned or some parts of it would be returned to the trial chamber rather than the appeals chamber convicting somebody who was acquitted. But again, this is simply speculation on my part because on the basis of what's happened, for example, at the ICTY. In terms of what Mr. Ayyash was found guilty of, he was found guilty of conspiracy aimed at committing a terrorist act. And as you rightfully pointed out, terrorism is defined in accordance with Lebanese criminal law. Also committing a terrorist act by means of an explosive device. He was found guilty of intentional homicide of Mr. Hariri with premeditation by using explosive materials. Also the intentional homicide of an additional 21 persons with premeditation by using explosive materials. And the attempted intentional homicide of 226 persons with premeditation using explosive materials. He was sentenced to 5 concurrent sentences of life imprisonment. But as I mentioned, he has not been arrested yet. So that remains the obligation of Lebanon.
Right. Thank you for that elaboration. So I just read that recently that the mandate of the court was extended by 2 years, even though the judgment has come out. So what is the reason for that?
Well, as I mentioned, there's another case. So Mr. Ayyash, the same person who was convicted in the main case, is also accused in the connected case. And this is a case regarding 3 other attacks against Mr. Marwan Hamede, which was an attempted assassination that occurred on the 1st of October, 2004. George Howey, on the 21st of June, 2005, and Elias El-Mur on the 12th of July, 2005. So these 3 attacks are the subject of the next case. So there's that. There's also the appeal in the main case, which is going to take some time as well. So this is probably what they have. I mean, what the mandate has been extended for 2 years, but of course, if the tribunal completes its mandate before then, it will be closed before then.
And does it have any budgetary issues in this regard?
Well, yes, along with everybody else, unfortunately, the SDL has also seen some very significant budget cuts this year. And it doesn't look like it's going to be spared next year either. But that is a combination of many different factors, not least of which, of course, is, well, one objective factor, of course, is the completion of the main case, which also necessitates a shrinking, if you will, of the activities. But also the pandemic and the impact that the pandemic has had, and also the economic situation in Lebanon, because Lebanon pays 49% of the budget of the Special Tribunal for Lebanon. So, and 51% is covered by voluntary contributions from different countries.
Okay, so moving beyond the case, let's talk about something which you have had a more active role to play in. The outreach program and the flagship inter-university program. Tell me a bit about that. How has that experience been for you? And what is the outreach program and what has it done, since it's started?
The inter-university program is really a fascinating accomplishment for all of us involved. So the outreach program, as I mentioned, was established at the outset, which was a very important message from the judges who drafted the rules of procedure and evidence, and that include also Lebanese and international judges. That's also worth mentioning. We mentioned that the tribunal is a hybrid tribunal. It means that it also has Lebanese judges and international judges, as well as Lebanese in every organ at senior functions. So the going back to outreach. So outreach was established from the outset. So basically from 2009. I joined in 2010. And by that time, the outreach office has conducted a number of very useful information campaigns and lectures and so forth. And so we realized there was still no indictment. So there was not much new that could be said. As you know, in all of these cases, investigations are confidential, as they must be. So there's very little that an institution can say in the at the time of the investigation. So what we realized was that there was a lot of information about what the SDL is, but not as much understanding of what it's supposed to be doing, because at that point, Lebanon had really little experience with, even Lebanese lawyers and academics had no experience basically with international criminal justice, because none of the institutions of international criminal justice actually concerned Lebanon as such, right? Not the ICC and certainly not any of the ad hoc tribunals. And so what we understood was that that the context is lacking. And so what we wanted to do is to offer the context of international criminal law and procedure as something that would assist at least students and academics in better understanding the work of the tribunal and other international criminal justice institutions. So we conceptualized a program that would be basically a course on international criminal law and procedure, but that would include all Lebanese universities that teach law. And so we started with 8 universities. We suggested that we organize a joint program. They agreed in principle, but then it was up to us to find a way to actually implement it. Then I spoke to the Asser Institute in The Hague, which became very interested in the project. And slowly but surely, we had a collaboration between the Special Tribunal for Lebanon, Asser Institute, and initially 8 and now 11 universities in Lebanon. What was remarkable is that when we first started with the program, which has been supported financially by the donors, when we first started with the program, the intention was to have maybe 30, 40 students per year. And that was considered to be a decent number given that it's such a niche area of law. What ended up happening is that over the years, the numbers, they started in well over 100 with well over 100 students and then steadily grew. And to date, nearly 1,200 students actually graduated from the course. And currently, the course has been moved online this year exceptionally, and it's now being implemented by the Asser Institute and an NGO that was established as part of this collaboration. And the STL has handed the project over to these two partners who continue to implement it with more than 350 students attending this year. The program also included a study trip to the Netherlands for those who did particularly well in their final exam, and some 120 Lebanese students traveled to the Netherlands over the years to visit the institutions over which they've been studying. They also visited Leiden University on some occasions. And so it was a very interesting and useful program that actually continues.
That's fantastic. It's really impressive to see that you have been collaborating with Asser Institute, which has been doing top-notch international law trainings and research for a very long time. And I've had the pleasure to attend a few of those sessions as well. And the sheer amount of numbers that you've just quoted, I'm sure the students, must see this as a very coveted program in this past 10 years, the sort of exposure that they must have received. So really happy to hear that. I also saw that, you've as part of the outreach program, you also did trainings and capacity building workshops and programs for lawyers other than students. What was that like?
Yes, indeed. We did several trainings for 5 years in a row, we did regular trainings for lawyers of the Beirut Bar Association. And then for the last couple of years, also the Tripoli Bar. So these are the two main bar associations in Lebanon, on the conduct of international criminal proceedings. They were interested in being trained as to how to how these international criminal proceedings work, because Lebanon is a country that follows the civil law tradition, which is slightly different, as you know, to the procedures that are applied in international courts, which are more are hybrid but follow more of a common law dynamic. And so they were very interested in being trained on that so that they can better understand and follow the proceedings or even join the list of defense counsel at the STL or the ICC, which some did. And so this was very interesting. What we would do is we would bring experts from abroad, and we would partner with the Bar Association and the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung here in Lebanon to bring these trainings to the lawyers. And they, some 120, 130 lawyers, if not, no, actually more than that, sorry. I think it was around 250 lawyers that actually participated in these trainings over the years. And each year we had actually more lawyers sign up than we could accept into the group, because part of the training is a moot court exercise, which of course has to, it requires that numbers be slightly limited. You cannot have too many people involved, otherwise it just doesn't work. And each year we had more people wanting to attend the training than we're able to. And of course we would then either put them on a waiting list or they would be able to join the following year. So there's been great interest in that. And as I mentioned also, the lawyers in Tripoli also also got the training in the last couple of years. So in addition to that, we did a training for NGOs on how to monitor international criminal proceedings, again, with the idea that they could monitor the work of the STL and the ICC if it becomes relevant to the local context. We also did a number of, in fact, several conferences. We did hundreds of lectures, all on topics of international criminal justice and the Special Tribunal for Lebanon, of course, particularly, but more broadly on international criminal justice. And so we've tried really to increase the amount. I mean, the whole purpose of all of our activities basically has been to increase the amount of accurate information that is available to people in Lebanon so that they can actually, when they make up their minds about the STL and the work of the STL, they do so on the basis of fact and not on the basis of disinformation that unfortunately spreads in Lebanon, same as it does pretty much anywhere else in the world.
No, perfect. That covers most of what we were supposed to discuss. And I'm sure you can find more information on the website of the court. And they have really, well-drafted annual reports. So you might want to check that out. Beyond STL, Olga, I'm aware that you have started your own foundation, Justicom. I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. Which has been working on international accountability mechanisms. So tell me a bit about that foundation before I let you go.
So the idea of Justicom, which has only just been established, is basically the tagline is communicating justice. So there's many accountability mechanisms, both international and hybrid. There's also national courts dealing with cases of universal jurisdiction and so on. So there's many, and there's also truth commissions and so forth. There's different mechanisms that deal with the aftermath of serious crimes. One thing that is common to all of them is that they struggle with communicating with their stakeholders, mostly the victims, of course, and the affected communities, but also policy makers and donors and so forth. And the reasons are many, because one thing is that these institutions are predominantly run by lawyers and judges. Their expertise lies in the law and the procedures and not in communications. And they also don't have the time, most of the time, to focus on that. They do have specialized public information and outreach departments, which are usually understaffed for what they're expected to do. In some cases, for example, we have seen with the trials based on universal jurisdiction that were held in Germany most recently in Koblenz, there were, the trials were held in accordance with the German law of procedural laws, which meant that the accused was provided with interpretation, right? But there is nothing in criminal procedure in Germany that requires the media to be provided with interpretation. And you could see how that could be a problem when the trial needs to be followed by people from Syria, right? And so there's these kinds of situations, which again, are just a consequence of these new developments. So the idea behind Justicom is to assist these organizations in better communicating with their stakeholders and to do projects that would that include trainings, that include educational activities, basically outreach in the broadest sense of the word, and also to assist in some cases where there hasn't been an accountability mechanism set up, but there are victims of crimes that are demanding justice, which is again being something that's happening more and more around the world, to assist them in identifying what is the best mechanism that might serve them depending on their circumstances. Because criminal justice, we must not forget, is only one part of transitional justice. And in some cases, it is the best option. And in other cases, there may be other better options that are better suited to the local context. So Justicom is trying to fill a gap that we have identified that exists in this area. So to communicate justice.
Right. And if somebody wants to reach out to you to, you know more about the work that you are doing or, you know, intend to do, where can they reach out to you?
They can reach out to me through my Gmail for the time being. And as soon as we establish all the online presence and everything else, that will be published on social media, of course, and we will try to publicize the existence. But as you know, it's very early stages yet, so we haven't had a chance to do that. But for those who want to reach me, they can reach me at Kavran, which is my last name, .Justicom@gmail.com.
All right, perfect. So that's all we have for this episode. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. And keep listening to your slogans, the International Podcast. I'll see you in the next episode. Thank you so much, Olga, for being on the podcast. It was lovely to have this discussion with you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.